I'm doing the intro this time?
No, I do the intro this
time. Oh, son of a bitch.
This,
all right, go ahead.
This is 19, right?
Yeah.
19, so 19.
Oh, that's right. I've been confused. Very good.
Okay, so I'm just going to count myself down.
Okay.
Oh, how do you want me to describe you?
Elegantly.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sneaky Dragon. My name is David Dedrick.
I'm Ian Boothby.
And today we're joined by Richard Starkings, the creator and writer of Elephant Men.
Get it right. Get it all right.
I got it right.
Get it all right.
He's a pioneer of digital lettering.
Sure. Made us say that.
Comic craft. And what's the other name of the... Oh, he's not allowed to speak yet. Sorry.
Until he's introduced.
Totally destroying podcast etiquette. Sorry. He's a father of three.
Master of none.
Thank you, Ian. And so let's welcome Richard. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Richard Starking.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Welcome to America.
It's a little late.
It is a little bit late. We're recording this in the United States of America. We're down for Emerald City Comic Con. So we're still here. We haven't been here for a week. I know that seems like it to you because our last one, we're in America and we're still in America.
Yeah.
But to us, only one day has passed. It's all a Doctor Who style time loop, bunch of bullshit. Dave's going to kill himself at some point. We're going to resolve it weekly in the last episode.
I'll have been this is me as a robot, not really me.
Okay.
Oh, it's a tessellation.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's nodding as if he's watched it, but he hasn't really.
Wait. No, yes, I have.
That's right. That's my co-host, Stuttering Dave. that's what he's known for. And we're so happy to have you here because we didn't think you were coming to Seattle. We thought, Richard ain't here. This ain't going to be a con. But all of a sudden, bang, bang, look
here
who's
I
here.
Am.
You
Party
are.
Party started.
Fantastic.
Party started on Sunday morning.
So you come to these cons. You sign your books, huge stacks of books that are all completely gone by the end of the cons usually.
That's the plan.
Yeah, you move through more books than like a Bible sale. It's amazing. And they're gone.
We're talking Gideon Bible salesman.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, any book that does well at a show is under-ordered by stores. Just a little message for retailers out there.
That is a good message.
Because right?
You know what? I want retailers to sell the book. I don't want to come to shows.
Exactly. That's not your damn job. Yeah. You're the creative force behind it.
Yes.
Yes. You're the beautiful dancer.
That's right.
It's not your job to build the stage.
Or the tiny dancer.
Oh, dancer for money. Do what you want me to do.
No, that's Private Dancer.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. Yeah. Tiny Dancer. Hold me closer, Tiny Dancer.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Elton.
You're going to cut those songs in, aren't you?
Yeah. We're going to do that.
We're
going to
show you. Is that a request?
Hold me closer, Tony Danza.
I'll cut that song in.
We'll find that from somewhere.
Sure.
Now, just to describe, again, Dave did a nice little description of what you do.
Okay.
Let's get a little bit of history.
What you've done.
You know what you've done.
I do.
Show me on the doll what you've done.
I remember most of it.
Okay.
Well, you know, I started my career in comics really as a 10-year-old, being dragged around shows, not quite like this one, more like flea markets. They were called comic marts in England. My brother had a huge collection of Marvel and DC comics, and he would take me to shows, and I would, you know, I started reading American comics. There was also the Marvel UK reprints.
Right.
So I actually got the job at Marvel UK, my first sort of staff job. I got that by, you know, I'd heard that you could get into, the best way into comics was to do some of the production work, one of which was lettering. And those were the days when you couldn't just buy a font and become a lettering artist.
Not like now.
You had to develop your skill.
The lazy bastards who do it that way
now. Those guys that buy our fonts, and we love them.
Yep, I'm just going to go. And, you know, yeah.
Comicbookfonts.com,
yeah.
Folks.
The only thing worse than the users are the dealers, am I right? Go ahead.
Absolutely. So I honed my lettering skills by, actually I drew Doctor Who comic strips, gag strips. This was around the time of Tom Baker's Doctor, and there was a lot of Doctor Who fanzines at the time, and my strip ran in TARDIS, which was the official organ, as they say, of the Doctor Who Appreciation Society.
That's right.
And I generated about 150 Doctor Who gag strips.
Wow.
But really, it was sort of to develop my pen lettering style. So I submitted those to Warrior Magazine, which is famous for running V for Vendetta and Marvel Man,
yeah.
And he actually ran a little feature on me in Warrior. And then I did some lettering work on some European strips that were being translated as a backup. And from there, I submitted work to Marvel UK. I worked on Transformers. We were generating more original Transformers comic strips than the US. because it was an extremely successful comic book that was outselling 2000 AD, which was, of course, the biggest boys adventure title at the time. And Transformers eclipsed 2000 AD for about a year because the Transformers craze was sort of in full tilt at that point.
I remember that time. I cried when Optimus Prime died. I'm not going to lie. Keep going.
Many children did, and parents cried. Parents cried because they could not get a hold of the toy that Christmas.
That's absolutely correct.
So I also worked on 2000 AD. I lettered some Future Shocks. At the time, people like Peter Milligan and Brendan McCarthy were sort of cutting their teeth at 2000 AD. And I sort of maintained those two careers. I was a production artist at Marvel UK, and I was a lettering artist with 2000 AD. That led to work on Detective Comics with Alan Davis and Paul Neary, because they didn't want the boards leaving the country, because that used to be a significant factor pre-digital, was that the cost of FedEx, which was absorbed by the big companies at the time, but it was phenomenal.
Right.
FedExing pages from England to the States, and in some cases just mailing them and leaving them to the vagaries of both postal
good
services.
Luck.
Yeah. So, and that's the way we ran things. We mailed things in England all the time. So I'd met Alan Davis through Marvel UK because he was still drawing Captain Britain at the time. He approached me to letter Detective Comics. I lettered 3 issues of Detective Comics. At the same time, I was asked by a friend what my dream lettering job was. And without missing a beat, I said, script by Alan Moore, art by Brian Bolland. And it didn't exist at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then like 2 months later, they announced that they were doing The Killing Joke.
Yeah.
And 6 months later, I was sitting next to Brian Bolland at a Birmingham comic show. And I said, do you happen to have anyone in mind to letter the book? And he just turned to me and said, oh, no, would you like to? And again, you know, the advantage was that the boards wouldn't have to leave London. And it also was appealing to Brian, who'd been waiting for the go-ahead for like a year. And so he hadn't taken any other work except maybe covers here and there. He was doing covers for the Judge Dredd reprints, the Eagle reprints. And it slowed him right down. So he was doing very few pages. And in fact, I started doing the pen lettering over his thumbnails. I mean, he would thumbnail the board. I mean, he wouldn't do tight pencils. He'd do very loose pencils because he didn't want to have to pencil and ink artwork that he didn't need to. So I actually helped speed up the production process. And I think we went through 3 editors at the time. I mean, there's different editors on that book. May have ended up being Karen Berger, but it took a year to be finished, and he'd already been working on a year. So, but I used to pick up pages 2 or 3 at a time. In fact, one time I took 1 page home to letter. That was right around the time I was editing Transformers, Thundercats, Real Ghostbusters at Marvel UK. I was the group editor of all the Boys Adventure titles at Marvel UK. And we launched some American format comic books to try and break into the American market. And one was called Dragon's Claws, one was called Death's Head, and the other one was called The Sleaze Brothers. And they all failed with sales of around 60,000.
Amazing.
Which, to our readers who are not readers.
Readers. It's a visual medium.
It is. Medium. Well, so a lot of people get this podcast in transcript form later.
That's right.
And they just
blind.
We do offer it.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Because blind people can't listen to podcasts. Yeah. That makes sense.
We need
we
to
translate it into Braille. Exactly. That's how radio works.
For blind people, we do a sign language transcript for them. So that's
which is just Dave shrugging his shoulder and waving his hands madly.
I don't know.
I'm going to backtrack and ask a whole bunch of dumb questions.
Sure.
Okay.
Can I ask the first dumb question?
Oh, please.
Because I wanted, when you mailed the artwork, was it mailed in tubes? I just always wondered.
No, it was flat.
Really?
Yeah.
See, that seems really dangerous.
Between 2 sheets of, you know,
like heavy cardboard?
Yeah.
Wow.
Wrapped in an oily rag.
Wrapped
with a lucky
in brown
pack of
paper.
Matches.
We got through rolls and rolls of brown paper.
I've seen things being shipped. So all I can imagine is everyone getting stuff with bent corners.
Well, actually, you don't want to roll inked artwork because actually ink can crack.
Oh, that's right.
And if there's any white out on it, that will definitely crack.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That is a really good tip. Here's my dumb question number one. Then there's a dumber question to follow. This doesn't mean we disrespect you. We're just dumb. 2000 AD, was that when you were working on it, was there ever any talk of what are we going to do when 2000 happens? Are we going to have to change the title of the magazine?
Yes, there was. I remember even in the 80s, they were discussing what they would do when 2000 AD came around. And in fact, they did, I think they did a pullout called 3000 AD, which may have been, you know, thinking about what are we going to do come the end of the next decade?
Because right now it seems like daring, amazing stories of the past, of 12 years ago, back when cyborgs ruled the earth and vicious lawmen dispensed justice. Remember?
Yeah, but you know, Space 1999.
That's right.
They haven't updated that.
2001, no one's like updated that. Yep.
And I think they made the right decision because 2000 AD is now, you know, the meaning has transferred. It's like Beijing before and after. No, actually Tiananmen Square. You know, Tiananmen Square used to mean a place where people meet. Now it means a place where the people were crushed.
Right.
And I think 2000 AD sort of now has a, you know, when you see the logo, you don't actually think of the word, you think of Judge Dredd and Strontium Dog and all those great
It's its own thing, definitely,
It's like the police box in Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People look at the police box now, and even though it's got the words police box written on it, children will say, there's the TARDIS.
Yep. Yeah.
There's nothing saying TARDIS on it, but it's become a visual icon, much like the drawing of the telephone handle that's on your cell phone.
Yes. Oh, yes, that's right.
You know.
That's right. Well, it still bothers me, and this is a visual thing, when people mime using the phone and they bring the fingers up. We're
banana.
Doing it. Like, it's kind of the hang loose, but you put one up to the ear, one to the mouth. I'm like, what's that?
Yeah.
You know, no, sir.
Well, as I pointed out before, taking your fingers and holding them like you're holding a phone and going like that.
Again, going like that doesn't help us at all.
I know, it's not
going to
help, but
in the transcript form,
it
doesn't make no sense.
It basically looks like you're jerking off. That's basically what it is. It's like, call me, jerk off.
Yeah, but actually people do that now.
Again, this doesn't help us at all. You know when people do this?
Okay.
How about that?
I was actually describing it afterwards you cut me off.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry.
I was doing the little playing the piano.
That's what I always think it means.
Which means text me, email me, you know.
Okay, because I'm always like, I don't play.
But we can always use the flat hand to suggest the iPhone. Call me.
Or the two fingers to be the ear thing that you hang off your ear, whatever that. Black noise, blue face. Blackface. I've got that new blackface thing. It's very offensive. When I was a kid, I used to get comics from England. And we got the two things. One, you got almost the telephone books with the big trades of every Marvel comic like jammed together. You'd have Captain Britain and those would be in color.
Right.
And then you get a bunch of black and white Hulks and those are really cool. So I'd like those, but they would always be random, not in order. Sometimes the same stories, like you'd have issue 50 of something like, but before that you'd have issue 70 of it and it would all just be nuts. So I get those. But then my grandparents would also bring me Superman and Batman hardcovers where they translated it from English to English and they dumbed it down. So it was all like Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams, but it wasn't proper dialogue. It was just like, oh, I'm mad at you. Take my fist. And it was just, who does this and what's the deal with these?
I remember there was some change we made where we changed Eisenhower to Winston Churchill or something. And I just remember thinking, why? Why are we doing this?
Yeah.
You know, let's not learn anything about American culture, which in actual fact, I think there's that, you know, the love of superhero comics in England, which still remains to this day, is a love of American pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that things happen differently, you know, and as a young reader, I would scurry to look up what something meant, you know, if I didn't know. And if even the word neighborhood has a different meaning, you know, friendly neighborhood, Spider-Man, it has a different meaning in America than neighborhood means in England. When I think of neighbors in England, I think of the soap opera.
That's right.
With Kylie Minogue. Yeah. And neighborhood has a cozier, warmer soap opera feeling to it. But friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, suddenly, you know, the word is in a different context and you take the U out of it.
Yeah, it kind of bugs me when people we don't. We keep it real.
Yeah, but we're in America.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, we do have to check our U's at the border.
Yes, that's right.
Please just leave your U's, sir. and please leave your healthcare.
That did happen to me when I came across the border.
That's right.
He said, would you say color? I said, color. He said, say it again. Color? He said, that's better.
Now, please go over to the lever department and we're going to discuss that for a little bit.
Where do you put the R?
I think that's a big problem. Like when I'm writing dumb animation in Canada, you know, we always have the thing of like, will kids understand this? Who cares if kids understand this? Kids, when you're a kid, you're supposed to learn things.
Yes.
You should always like aim higher than what a child knows, because why would you like to do things for a child that they already know? What a waste of a child's time.
But, you know, I had a friend.
Or anyone's time, frankly.
A fellow comic collector in England astonished me when he told me he didn't read captions in comics.
Mm.
And I actually think this is more common than you might think. And I honestly believe one of the reasons that Walking Dead is so successful is there are no captions.
Right.
So you get all the story. But I think that there are people, you know, when my sister told me she skip read, you know, she'd read a book. I had so much, lost so much respect for her because she'd read so many books.
Yeah.
And I was like, you mean I'm slaving away reading every single word? And then when I daydream, I go back and read a page again because I don't want to miss anything. And I think that, you know, a lot of people, you know, my mum used to say she didn't like, not descriptions, but she would sort of skip certain kinds of things. She wouldn't get to the story so she could read the story faster. You know, I think that people read comics in very different ways. Some people, it's a purely visual experience. Some people, they really want to read it. And I think those are the sort of Neil Gaiman readers. And, mm-hmm. you know, the writers that are very much like illustrated prose. You know, there's different audience out there, but we all sort of look the same.
Well, I think my theory on the caption thing, and I'll talk about, I'm going to tangent to something also, I'm going to say dumb later. people get into comics through comic strips for the most part. That's the first thing you read.
Gag strips,
and or even soap opera strips, and there's still no caption boxes in those. So it's something new when you pick up a comic. It's like, oh, what's that business?
Yeah.
But they've done a thing recently where thought in mainstream comics, at least, I don't know if it's the same thing in Elephant Men, but there's no thought balloons anymore.
Yeah.
They've gone, thought balloons are too cheesy, but all they've done is change the thought balloons to caption boxes. Caption. So you just read their thoughts in the caption boxes. How's that any different?
Yeah.
But I
actually do thought bubbles in Elephant Men.
Good for
specifically,
you.
Specifically, because I think it's a shame to throw away the tools that are unique.
I completely agree with that. Yeah.
You know, and I don't mind internal narratives, which sort of Frank Miller made very, very popular with Daredevil, and then specifically with Electro Assassin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of internal narrative, which in a way makes it more Pulp Fiction. You know, really the internal narrative comes from, I remember a TV series called Harry O, where Harry always narrated the episode. And that was sort of my first exposure to that noir, you know, voice in your head. You're being told from one perspective. So it's, you know, it's the sort of Chandler-esque.
Yeah, definitely.
The way he describes the world is the way that you can, it's the only way you can perceive the world, because you need to be in that sort of seedy, dire,
and
sleazy.
You get his jaundiced view.
You get his jaundiced view.
Yeah.
And I think what happened to the detriment of the caption, the narrative caption in comics, was that suddenly everybody had a freaking narrative caption. And I'd be told by editors, make these blue, make these yellow. And, you know, I do use that myself in terms of, you know, when the caption is describing the internal world. I think it's good to have the third person narrative describe the internal world. But once it becomes one first person narrative over the other, you've got to be very, very careful that you're consistent and that you follow through.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading some comic recently where one page had captions, and it's like, no, you can't do that. You can't just suddenly switch to a third person narrative because your storytelling is weak.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there are some writers that do the internal narrative very well, which is like Alan Moore does it very well and Frank Miller does it very well. Because you're literally, that's the voiceover, you know, it's the one that you would remove from Blade Runner if you have any sense, you know. Right. So,
but it can get over the top. Like I personally think that Alan Moore gets a little over the top with his use of narrating things that you can see in the image. And you can especially see that in like an EC Comics, where there's a huge, they dense captions describing exactly what the picture is already showing you. You don't really need that kind of
description. I wouldn't say Alan Moore does that so much. You know, I think both Alan Moore and Frank Miller write against the image,
okay.
You know, which I think is the right way to do it. And I love reading Alan Moore comics because it's a layer cake. There's so much going on in the artwork that he's described to the artist. So he's taking responsibility for that, and he's adding an extra layer in the dialogue and the narrative captions. But, you know, that's a great example of, you know, Rorschach's journal is a great use of a internal narrative that isn't actually an internal narrative. He's writing it down. So his internal narrative is something physical in the world, too, that actually plays an important part in the plot of Watchmen, because it's the journal that's found the New Frontiers.
And I like in that it's lettered very uniquely. Yeah. It's not just, my problem right now is that is something they're doing, which is the multicolored caption boxes. And you read an issue of the Avengers, and at one point, everyone's got their own color box. You don't remember who it is, but it looks like a gay pride flag is going, and everyone's saying their business. And I'm like, okay, well, this is beautiful, and we've used every color of the rainbow, but what the hell? Just put a
balloon. No, and I agree. I think that's sort of, that's one of the sort of downsides of digital lettering and digital coloring, is that everything is manipulable after the fact. Whereas, you know, in the days of, you know, 64 colors, you had to choose very carefully. So you chose primary colors for caption boxes, because then you can read them. And these days, you know, I've had to tell guys that have worked for me, don't put purple on a caption box, it'll make it hard to read, you know. But not everybody's thinking along those lines, but I'm sort of thinking from the old days of, why is Spider-Man Superman, why is it red and blue? It's because it's simpler to separate. And villains are green and purple because they're slightly more complicated, but they will appear less in the strip. You know, that you use browns, purples, and you know, three color combinations more sparingly, because it's more work for the separator, so it won't get done as quickly. And everything in comics is about time or money.
Yeah.
You know, so even color choices can be affected by that.
That explains all the blue suits you see in, or like in Ditko Spider-Man.
Cyan. Yeah. 100 cyan.
Yeah, yeah.
Quick and easy.
Yeah.
You know, and even the colorist that's doing those roughs is marking it up, and they want to be quick too. Mm-hmm. You know,
he was very close to being called Cyan Man, right off the top. Very, very close.
Cyan Man? Cyan.
Does everything cyan can. And basically just colors things blue. That's all the cyan can do, frankly.
But, you know, when you mention...
and the cyans have a plot.
You know, the
plan.
Simple lettering for Rorschach, that's Dave Gibbons. You know, he's very simple and very effective, and he doesn't over-elaborate. It's the clear choice, you know. And I think, again, one problem with digital lettering, and, you know, the fact that we have over 250 comic book style fonts in our library, is that people don't realize when I letter Elephant Men, I use a very limited palette of choices because I want the style to be clean and simple. But if I thought to myself, well, you know, I can use a different font on every page for sound effects, captions, then I'm actually throwing more obstacles in front of the reader to get into the story.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've worked with writers as a lettering artist that wanted way more elaboration in terms of lettering. You know, I had a big argument with Kurt Busiek on Arrowsmith because he wanted a Germanic font for the Germans, a sort of more French font for the French. And I was like, well, what does that mean? What font do they speak in when they're speaking English with a French accent? Once you go down that road, you know, you are asking for way more than the sort of vocabulary of comics allows for. And I said that there's a problem in that if you want a reveal of a character and they're speaking a German accent, it limits. It's like, oh, the reader immediately knows it's going to be one of a few characters, even if he's speaking off panel. So I always argue against making something more complicated than it needs to be, even though sort of Comic Craft was famous for, you know, utilizing that. But, you know, I was very resistant to things like, there's an editor at DC who likes the little symbol of that character in the caption box. And I don't mind that at the beginning of a sequence of captions, but not in every single one. And that editor was insistent on having it in every single one. And, you know, that to me is like, well, now you've given up. You know, now you may as well say, and Robin says, you know.
It does feel a little hand-holding.
Yeah, if it's not written well, it, you know, it's not going to be clear no matter how much, you know, icing you put on the cake. You know, it doesn't, you know.
And I was just going to say that there already is a, can't think of the word now, but there already is, you know, with the little pointy brackets.
Translations.
Indicate that someone's speaking in another language. So there already is that standard. Yeah. So why change that? You know,
the carrot tops, we call them.
Is that right? Yeah. Yeah. We have those, I wish I could think of the word, but you know what I mean. We already have those
brackets?
These devices.
Greater and less
it's
than?
Not, the word isn't device. Yeah. We already have these sort of devices that we use, you know, whether it's anger lines or sweat lines or whatever. Why change those things that we already read and know right away what
unless
it means,
you can borrow some good ones from Japan, in which case borrow those for a bit and use them.
But that's again incorporating a language. It's just like, you know, when
but it's hard to know what it means.
That's not entirely true, because if you're listening to somebody speaking Japanese and they say Kit Kat in the middle of the sentence, you know they mean the same thing that we mean when we hear the word Kit Kat. And the meaning becomes obvious in the usage. Mm-hmm. So I think you can. I like the idea of embracing elements.
To a degree, but if someone has a snot bubble coming out of their nose, a big snot bubble coming out of their nose, it's not immediately obvious that they're sleeping. Sleeping. I think I mean sleeping.
I think you got a different picture in your head.
And then there's another one where blood is spreading out of their nose means that they're aroused.
Like those if there's a Kit Kat coming out of their pants, they're really aroused.
Especially if it's the chunky Kit Kat.
That's
oh, my
right.
God.
But or the 14-finger bar.
But you know what I mean, right? Like those things, they're not instant. You have to stop and think about it. Whereas if you see someone
But, you know, my kids are growing up now with an exposure to iconography that we can't even grasp.
That's true.
You know, when I was sitting at the dinner table like a year or so ago and
last time you saw your kids
and they were saying hey apple and I was like, why is that funny? You know about the annoying orange?
Yes.
Yeah. So it was the annoying orange sketch. And, you know, there's so many things that I realize now that because I'm not hooked on YouTube every night like my kids can be, that there's messages kids are receiving that I'm not receiving. And because of the industry in which I work, I'm fairly aware of things going on. Have you seen that little pixel cat that just...
Oh, it's Dave's favorite.
The Ancat.
And there's like how many variations on that are there now? And I only found out about that last week because I went to a presentation by Google engineers and they were talking about memes. But there are so many memes out there now and so many videos being uploaded and so much artwork being uploaded. I mean, you know, there's art now. The way to get noticed now, you can get noticed through DeviantArt. You can get noticed through Facebook or Twitter or whatever it is. And you know, we're more aware of these images going on. My kids grew up reading Shonen Jump, my boys.
Yeah.
And so they understand comics through manga, not through the American comics that I grew up on.
That's my youngest daughter's that way too.
Yeah. So they've learned some different shorthand, you know, comic book shorthand things that maybe I didn't. But what's interesting, I mean, something like Adventure Time, I became aware of that because my son was TiVoing it, and I was like, what the hell is Adventure Time? And then I noticed at San Diego last year or the year before that people were dressed as it. Everybody was rushing to the booth, you name it. And there's something about Adventure Time that sort of hits that manga, but Tom and Jerry, it sort of hits all those cultural influences.
It's really strange, but it also has this kind of weird alternative cartoon kind of thing to it too. Like,
The fact that the unicorn speaks Korean. Right? Is it the unicorn or is it the...
Are you talking Princess Bubblegum's unicorn?
Yeah.
The rainbow corn?
Yeah.
Am I thinking of that correctly? Yeah, I think so.
Speaks in Korean. It's brilliant.
I was just discussing this with the editor of the comic books minutes ago. I may be working on that book. I don't know. How do you know? You don't know. Anyway, but I was saying that it's so much like a dream. You know, sometimes the episodes end before they should end. Sometimes they end incredibly dark. Mm-hmm. Things get really creepy. You just tangent off. Things sometimes don't make sense. But there's always like an emotional through line that does make sense.
Yes.
And it's like, that's what a dream's like. And for a kid watching that, bang on.
I
they
think
get
the first
that.
Episode was called My Two Favorite People or something. And that to me sort of captures why it's attractive is because the characters really like each other.
Yes.
And everything is generated by that.
Yeah.
And I watched an episode recently where what's the dog called?
Jake
was in the pocket of Finn the whole episode.
Yep.
But that only makes an appearance at the end. Yep. You know, and but the kids get that, you know.
Absolutely.
We watched the episode and they cracked up, and one of my kids said, he could have solved the problem right at the beginning. So my kids are completely aware of where a plot could have gone if a different character had appeared. And, you know, we were talking briefly about Futurama last night, and you were saying how frustrating it is for you that things that could have been tied up more neatly were sort of rushed.
Actually, that's Simpsons, because they now have a four-act structure.
That's right.
That's right.
But But the thing is that 20 years of Simpsons has educated children to think in a different way than the three-act structure, mm-hmm. you know. So, and who are we to say that they're wrong? It's kind of like when you've, if you've ever read Story by Robert McGee.
Yes.
And then you watch Adaptation, which makes fun of Story by Robert McGee, you know, that there's a danger of us falling into comfortable patterns. And in a sense, you know, sound effects, thought bubbles in comics, maybe what had happened is that they'd become crutches and we needed to sort of chase them away to understand why we need them back. And I think sometimes there's elements of vocabulary in comics that you need to question in order to understand why you have them there. And I found in writing an ongoing comic that you know, which has been optioned, you know, the structure of a movie and the structure of a comic book, completely different things. And one of the things...
Or should be.
But yes, they should be.
And sometimes they're not, and that's a mistake.
And they're different to serial television too, because one of the frustrations people used to have with Chris Claremont's X-Men was that plot threads would take years to come to satisfying conclusions. Mm-hmm. And it was the most successful comic book in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Coincidence. Because people do have way more patience than we give them credit for. If sure. you're telling an engaging story, and Chris Claremont had a lot of great engaging stories,
mm-hmm.
Lots of ideas, lots of interesting characters, lots of emotional development. And he did take a long time to resolve plots. But because he was the writer of the book, he would keep it over here and get back to it. And I've realized... in writing Elephant Men, stories that I thought would be resolved by issue 15, I'm still not resolved at issue 35 because characters develop. Characters,
they do their own thing.
They do their own thing.
And that is what is compelling about writing and reading comics.
Please.
It is a grand plan. It unfolds of its own accord, and we enjoy seeing that happen and pursuing it.
I agree. I think like something with Claremont is because he pulled off something like the Phoenix story, and it was so amazing that when things, little threads got laid out, it's like, oh, he's pulled this off before. Let's see where this is going. But I think that's one trick that writers need to know is like, you've got to show, it's like stand-up. When you go out and you do stand-up, you can't start with your long-winded joke. You got to start off with your, I'm going to prove to you that I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Are we all comfortable that I know what I'm doing? Now I can get into the longer, weirder stuff. And I think like sometimes when comic book writers and creators start off, they go, I'm going to tell this long story. I know the end. It's 500 issues from now, but man, it's going to pay off. Okay. But before you do that, remember there's a first issue and we got to see you know what you're doing.
You know, one of my favorite stand-up is Eddie Izzard.
Mm-hmm.
And he will actually pay off a joke that he set up in a tour 10 years ago. You know, if you follow his shows and if you follow that, you know, he does DVDs of all of his shows, you'll realize that you're laughing at something he referenced, you know, in 2001.
I'm an Eddie Izzard fan. I would love to see, and I can see this happening because he does so many marathons, but like an actual stand-up marathon, I would love to see him run like a half marathon. People run with him and he does his act to the people who can continue running. And his act is so good. They're like, I'm exhausted, but I got to see how this joke pays off, and you got to just keep going. And like, can you run and laugh at the same time?
Can you run and do stand up at the same time?
I think he could if he can do stand up in languages that he doesn't himself know, which is what
and
he does.
And make people who don't fully understand that language laugh. Because I have enough French. I mean, the thing is, he's coming from British high school French,
mm-hmm.
so I can listen to his French show and it cracks me up because he's really making fun of the way French has been taught in British schools,
mm-hmm.
okay. which, you know, le chat est sous l'arbre.
Yeah.
Maintenant, le...
La plume de ma tante est sur la table.
Yeah. Mais sur la table, n'est pas sur
oui,
la table.
Oui, c'est bon.
So, you know, even in his French stand-up, he's sort of teaching you French and then making you laugh at what he's taught you.
Yeah.
And he does a great, you know, the Michael Caine movie, The Italian Job?
Mm-hmm.
He describes the plot of The Italian Job in French, and it's one of the most, you know, hilarious sketches he does because every British person knows The Italian Job.
Yeah.
And has learned a smattering of French at school. So.
Well, I did improv with Eddie Izzard a couple of times in Vancouver back before he kind of hit it big, and he'd come to the comedy festival and then jam with us afterwards and was the sweetest guy. And he was one of those guys that, you know, would always tell people, oh, this guy, check him out, but this is before the internet. And you're just like, where are you going to see him? I don't know. If he comes to town, you should see him. But it was annoying because his show would do okay, and then there was a guy who would stick a firework up his ass and sing "There's No Business Like Show Business" while it's going off, and that guy sold out. But then he failed because he decided to bring his wife along on the tour and went, you know, my wife misses me when I'm on tour, so I'm going to go tour with her. So it's Rocket Up the Ass, but then she sings opera. And you think, together, that's not a bad Muppet-style act. But it's not, no, she's going to sing opera for about 30 minutes. Let's be respectful. Then I'm going to stick the rocket up my ass, and we'll go to town. Whereas
there's
Eddie's
a lesson there for everybody.
Yeah,
yes.
go see Eddie.
Something to do with opera?
Yeah.
That's a lesson I'm taking out of it.
So, dumb question number three.
Oh, geez. Now I've forgotten that one. Let me go with this one. Comic Sans font. What the hell's with that?
What's up with Comic Sans? You know, it's like any artifact of an era where there wasn't much competition. You know, Whizbang was the other font that when we started selling our fonts, Whizbang was a font that somebody had made. They'd scanned comic book lettering and not put it together with the sort of same integrity, I would say, that we approach putting fonts together. And because they were out there and because it was the only available font, they propagated. So Comic Sans is part of, it comes with Adobe, I think. I think it comes
yeah,
with
yeah, it's program, a little freebie so. One. It's just odd.
And it does offend my sensibilities. I mean, it's like the FBI warning that's on a lot of DVDs. The kerning between the W and the A is often way off. And I'm like just about to watch a movie I'm looking forward to, and I'm like, oh no, I'm thinking about the kerning between W and A.
So everyone knows the kerning is the spacing between each letter. So if you have a W,
of course,
and
we
a,
all know what the kerning is.
Not everyone knows,
but you know what? Nobody used to know the word font, and now people do know the word font because they need them to use a computer.
Yeah.
And we're living again in an era where, you know, words like wireless have come back into fashion, and who knows what other words will come back just because we need a word. And wireless means wireless.
Do you know what bugs me is, I looked up the other day, Wi-Fi. Do you know what Wi-Fi stands for?
Wireless fidelity.
No, it stands for nothing. The Wi-Fi stands for absolutely nothing. They just made up the word. It's its own word.
Oh, interesting.
Because it sounds like hi-fi. That sounds like a thing. So they just called it Wi-Fi at the end. It does not stand for wireless.
It doesn't mean wireless fidelity.
Means dick fucking all is what it means.
I just thought it meant why fidelity.
Yeah, I'm sure. Why, as in like you're questioning why we need fidelity?
Yeah, why fidelity?
Oh,
it's
okay.
Kind of an existential
thing. Ironic hipster kind of thing.
Why?
Yeah. Why?
Why?
Why fidelity?
Who? Where? When? Whither?
I think it's interesting. I'm thinking about the aesthetics you're talking about before with lettering, where there are so many, like as you say, you have 250 fonts. There is probably 100,000 or more fonts to choose from. And it's tempting for anyone, whether designing a poster for a garage sale or whatever, to just layer it on
there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of ideas to choose from. And I think that what we need now is, you know, Adventure Time is a great sort of example of someone that has selected ideas that seem to make no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And they make perfect sense because of the integrity with which he's assembled those ideas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, superheroes, you know, it's easy to understand why, you know, Joe Public will look at a comic convention and just see the cosplayers and make a judgment. You know, in fact, somebody interviewed me.
I certainly do.
Because of the nature of Elephant Men being animals, you know, somebody asked me about, well, what do you think about the furries community? And it's very tempting to make fun of it because it's an easy target. But that clearly has touched a chord, just the same way steampunk has touched a chord.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not for us to judge why it's been struck. It has been struck. And the moment you start to judge, it's a slippery, slippery slope. You know, so
suddenly it's a CSI Las Vegas storyline. Do you remember that one on the furries?
I heard about it. Yeah,
it was kind of the furry equivalent of the Quincy punk rocker episode.
But here's why you can actually do a CSI about it, because it's non-specific, and steampunk is non-specific. But the moment you put a stormtrooper in a CSI episode, it's got to be licensed.
Oh, okay.
You know, so in a way, it's sort of like, well, because we kind of scared about these women with tails and ears and think.
They're anonymous, right? That's scary to people. That idea of that people are hiding behind something.
But, you know, we have a big crossover audience with Fables. And so I had to read Fables to find out why Elephant Men and Fables have crossover audience.
And why is that?
I'm talking curious. Animals. And we have both have a 50-50 female-male readership.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a woman more readily accepts a talking animal. You know, whereas a man, it's sort of a, well, it's an animal. It's kind of, you know. So for me, you know, Hip Flask and the Thing are not very different. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the way I see Hip Flask as being a character like the Thing, a tragic character.
Yeah.
You know, and the Thing was like one of my favorite Marvel characters when I started reading comics. So I sort of don't see it the way perhaps other people see it. And I know that, you know, the moment you put a massive weapon in the hands of the Elephant Men, it's more appealing to men. Mm-hmm. You know, War Toys, the Elephant Men War Toys series is more appealing to the male audience, whereas the ongoing series seems to be more appealing to a female audience. And I think that, you know, men are much more likely to dismiss a category out of hand because don't associate me with that. And I think that the reason that there are a lot more female readers, and especially younger girls, coming out of manga, where the interesting thing about manga and anime in particular is the Japanese mindset is we don't care what the logic of this story is. It looks cool. Mm-hmm. And we don't care about whether this character could work in the real world or not. It's just fun and entertaining. Whereas the sort of the American male mindset is, tell me what the origin story is.
Yeah, break it down. Give me the Marvel Universe specs.
Yes. Where's the handbook?
Yeah, in Japan, I think it's like, again, with Adventure Time, the logic might not be there, but is the emotion true? If the emotion is true, then you're absolutely fine.
Exactly.
And that's the problem. Like most comics, even if you read old Marvel comics, DC, you go like, well, this is ridiculous. Superman couldn't. Spider-Man couldn't. Yeah, but the emotion feels right. Then you're there. Right. And when you were talking about the male-female talking animal thing, I think what that comes down to is you become, when you're a boy, you don't want to be seen hanging around with toys that are below your age range. And talking animals seems like, oh, you like teddy bears and fuzzy da-da-da-da, and that's looked down upon. So you go, no, none
Whereas
of that
Whereas a female sensibility actually will continue that. Well, you know, the Hello Kitty phenomenon.
Yeah. Yes.
No, right. But, you know, what is emotional true also it addresses the fact that whatever you emotionally imprint on between 7 and 12, it's like the little duck in the Bugs Bunny cartoons that there's the little yellow bird in Tom and Jerry that imprints on Jerry or Tom or whatever.
I think that's Plucky Duck, I think.
But you know what, whatever
and also Quacky
you imprint
Doodle Dandy
on, you know, if you grew up with Thundercat, you don't realize that Thundercats is not a very good cartoon show.
Yeah.
Right? Sure. So, you know, I realized that when I tried to teach writers as the editor of Thundercats how to write a Thundercat story. It's pretty difficult because there's one villain, you know, and it's Mumra, and it's an endless loop, and it doesn't feel satisfying. Whereas it's easy to tell a G.I. Joe story. It's easy to tell a Transformers story because they have a little bit more thought behind them. But it doesn't matter to you if you're now 30 and you remember Thundercats cartoon coming on and sort of your head exploding, you know, because it was like Thundercats ho, you know. So you know, I think that we, you know, the generation our age that has grown up on superheroes carries that emotional imprint with us. And my boys have not sort of emotionally imprinted with superheroes in comics, but my son Jet is definitely connected to them in the movies, and he keeps asking me, Dad, who are the Avengers again? Is the Hulk going to be in the Avengers movie? So, and I remember when the lineup changed around issue 34 of Avengers. Do you remember when Scarlet Witch, Quicksilver, and Hawkeye moved in, and Thor and Iron Man
were
out?
What are those criminals doing moving in?
And it was so exciting to read that story, and I was reading a reprint, and it's like my world fell apart, you know, because I was at the right emotional age to care about that. And in my internal world, it was very challenging to me that I was going to have to learn about some new characters who may be up to no good. And but Thor, you know, Iron Man, where are you going? So you know, we carry that emotional imprint forever. So you see the trailer for the movie as somebody that read the comic book, and it's like, Hawkeye's in the team. But I was actually talking to my son yesterday about Hawkeye, because he said to me once, archery lessons for his birthday next month. And I said, is that because of Hawkeye and the Avengers? And he said, who? Because he hasn't got an emotional connection to Hawkeye yet.
The Hunger Games.
Yeah. No, they didn't enjoy the Hunger Games so much. But
are you talking about the movie? Because the books I think the book's really popular with female readership.
Yes, definitely. My daughter is the one that came home and started reading Volume 2 of Hunger Games. And I bought them for my son, my oldest son, like 2 years ago. And they just sat on the shelf.
My daughters went through it like 5 years. Like whenever it started, they were both... it's interesting when you talk about that, because see, in my family, I am not a superhero fan. I guess I imprinted on Archie, Tintin, Asterix, that sort of books. And when I was older and when I started buying books for myself, I you know, I did buy some superhero. I read Watchmen and I read Dark Knight, but I didn't wasn't interested in the really long serial, you know, the X-Men and things like that. My oldest daughter loves superhero comics. She loves Runaways. She loves, well, not, I wouldn't really say superhero, but more like Why the Last Man. She loved those kind of books. My youngest daughter could care less about either of our tastes. She loves manga. She loves to read the high school romance manga. You know, the more gloriously girlish the boys look, the better for her. Because there's something that the girls at that age love about these kind of, you know, sort of, what's the word I'd be looking for? I guess neutral.
Gender
boys.
Neutral, yeah.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about Facebook now is how you can get to know the internal world of someone by their Facebook wall. Mm. Because when you're in the world and you're at a show, your focus is in one place, but you don't really know where somebody else's focus is. But Facebook shows you where people's focus is. Mm. And I think that's why, you know, that kind of social networking interaction works, is because you can gravitate towards similar tastes, mm-hmm. and you can unfriend people who don't have your tastes. So,
is that what happened?
But I think the same's true in comic books. What Vertigo did, Vertigo provided a place for manga readers to go, even though Vertigo kind of preceded the manga craze. What I see is that a lot of young girls especially started reading the Tokyo Pop reprints. And then when they needed somewhere to go, the great thing about manga was they hadn't educated people as to what they should be reading or what genre you should prefer. So even Vertigo sort of started out mostly horror because of Swamp Thing and because of titles like that. Vertigo became a place where you could go into a bookstore and find something like Fables, like Sandman or Why the Last Man. And it's an easy transition, partly because the sort of non-genre specific, but, you know, sort of broad fantasy
right.
aspect, but also because there were limited series in volumes numbered from 1 to 10 or 1 to 12, which manga educated readers to follow a series in a way that superhero comics has not done as effectively.
Well, when you're talking about the Claremont stories go on for decades, that's no good when you're picking up a trade. Where do you start? I don't know.
Well, you know, Marvel had to publish this How to Read Marvel Comics pamphlet.
Yeah.
And they've done two or three of them now.
Yeah.
And it's insane, you know, start with the masterworks and then you
and then trades. But there are all these books that are out of print, so pick this up, which doesn't exist anymore, then try to find this somewhere.
And by the way, when we have a different creative team, we'll restart the numbering from volume one, so it's, you know, like Fantastic Four. Or
and let me explain the whole Spider-Man marriage thing. Here's what you might see: that he's married and go, why isn't he married later? Well, it's a funny story of Satan and da 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 da. But when you're talking about, I just want to get back to the what you should and what you shouldn't, because I think it ties into a couple of things we've been talking about, where like you look down on furries, and there's like, I think as a nerd, you want to have someone to look down on.
Yeah.
You know, I like Wolverine, but I don't like a guy dressed as a Wolverine. That's
with the tail.
That's ridiculous. Yeah, exactly. Which always bugs me. I think, like, you know, whatever floats your boat, if you're not hurting people, that's great. But yeah, you have that real no that. You know, this is stupid and this is okay. And with Vertigo, something that bothers me about that line is, almost all the Vertigo books started in the superhero world. You know, your Swamp Thing, your Sandman, first couple of issues had like the Justice League. He's dropping by. You know, you had your Doom Patrol. And then as it went on, there was a real feeling of like, but that's a little dumb. We're above that now. We've moved beyond. And I get why you're doing it, but you miss the entry point of like,
appreciate that they've pulled Animal Man and Swamp Thing back into the DC universe because that's where they originated.
Yeah.
And I think there is a danger of saying, no, we're elevating certain characters as being above this flashy costume, bright and cheerful, you know. And I think superheroes should be bright and cheerful,
which they're really not. I mean, they've gone through, you know, almost every, you know, event. You know, you bring in the young characters, they get their arms torn off or their heads torn off, and it's just this person's killing this one, and it's brutal, and it's brutal violence that would have not been out of place in Vertigo books and would have had, you know, in the day.
We want our comics to grow up with us, but comics can't grow up with us the way music grows up with us, because music grows up with us because the people making the music are evolving and continue to be themselves and continue to react to whatever is affecting them. So, you know, I started out liking the Police, and then I followed Sting's career, and there's some music that really appeals to me that he's made, and sometimes I'm like, I don't know where you are now in your head, but yeah, a reunion tour is a good idea right now.
Mm-hmm. But, what about an album of lute music?
But, comic book characters can't do that, and you know, there's a famous quote of Stan Lee saying, he said, what we want is not progress, it's the illusion of progress. The characters seem to be progressing, and they, so the your characters are stuck in this loop, so you want the marriage because that's a spike of interest and it's something people sort of want, but then you don't know where to go with that. And I think that you know, I honestly,
so many, it was just a dream episode,
but I believe, you know, another reason, you know, The Walking Dead is successful, one creator, you know, one writer guiding it through all this time, being consistent,
and things happen, things can
things happening. And you know, when Robert started writing that book, he didn't have children. Now he has children, so he's a different person, so he's in, his characters are informed by his life experience and continues to be informed in the same way that, you know, if you've been reading Stephen King books since Carrie, you've seen his evolution as a writer. And in fact, if you've, one of the books I recommend to writers is his book on writing.
Yeah, it's a really good one.
It's very autobiographical and speaks to why his characters suffered so much when he was a cocaine addict. You know, the fact that the character Misery is tied to a bed with a nurse who hobbles him with, you know, breaks his ankles. Mm-hmm. And he basically realized in retrospect that that was his addiction. He was writing about his own addiction. And so it was compelling writing. Misery is one of my favorite books, you know. And in fact, you know, Pet Sematary, you know, is such a tragic book, you know, about the death of the child, Gage, that's hit by the truck. And you know, that's a parent writing that book. It's one of your deepest fears, you know. So, you know, I think that the sort of nature of superheroes is it sucks in younger talent because you want to be rebooting all the time. So you actually want somebody younger who's not going to develop the character in a certain direction. You know, when Frank Miller wrote the issue of Daredevil where he played Russian roulette with Bullseye, do you remember that one?
Yes.
He did an interview and he said, as far as I'm concerned, at the end of that issue, Matt Murdock went home, hung up his Daredevil suit, and never put it on again. And of course, because as a creator, you want that satisfaction of leaving something alone and moving on. But you can't do that with superheroes.
Because they're going to bring Elektra back.
But that's the attraction of creator-owned comics right now. And there's you know, such a strong trend of people who've worked at Marvel and DC many years bringing books that they've nurtured themselves. And I think it's an inevitable desire of a creator to control the destinies of their characters. And I think the more you can't guide the destiny of characters in a way that Claremont did for many, many years, 15, 20 years, he worked on the X-Men.
Yeah, maybe even longer. Yeah.
So he had that satisfaction. And I remember when he was fired in the early 90s, I said, does it feel like... I asked him something. He said, no, it feels like a divorce. It felt like his children were being taken away.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I thought that was a very powerful statement.
Right.
And true, because he had given life to these characters for 20 years, and it wasn't like they were leaving home. They were being ripped away from him.
Right.
But that was the danger. That's the danger of not owning what you create. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were discussing Watchmen last night, and... you know, the no matter on which side of the argument you fall with Watchmen, I was saying that DC has now made a very powerful statement to the creative community that if you've signed a certain deal, if they've paid you, if it's in writing that they can do it, they will do it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't matter whether it's Marvel or DC. They're within their rights. It's in writing. Mm-hmm. And I personally wouldn't rather they'd left it well alone. I think Alan's very outspoken about it. He needs to be. He's one of those extreme characters we need in the industry, right out there on the ledge, like Dave Sim was for many years. And you sort of think, oh, that crazy old hermit, you know, don't hang around with Ben, you know, Ben Kenobi. but you need them out there representing some... ideologies that have sort of got brushed under the carpet, you know.
But that's very, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's very, I think there's two forces. There's one, the creative force, which is let's move this car forward. And then there's the arrested development force, which is I want things to be, or at least feel like when I was young and I first fell in love with what this is. So you get, you know, something like DC going, we got to bring Barry Allen back. you know, I know Hal Jordan just went evil and like tried to kill everybody, but we're bringing him back. Watchmen has to come back. Yeah. And with Marvel, Spider-Man's got to be single. And it's all that, it's the pullback. It just feels like back in the car.
What's interesting is that this is why Doctor Who is one of the best story concepts out there, because it can reboot. It's within its own parameters, it can reboot.
Yes.
Within the nature of time travel, there can be parallel dimensions. There can be, you know, I love the throwaway line in the first Amy season where she doesn't remember the Daleks and the Cybermen fighting over London because something has gone awry. Yeah. And so you can reboot effortlessly with throwaway lines. You can make things new again. And it's built into the structure of the evolution of the story. So the story continues to develop. You get different characters as the Doctor.
Right.
Well, yeah, just that brilliant idea of having the Doctor, whatever they call that, when he regenerates.
Yeah. Simple, brilliant idea. But so brilliant, mm-hmm. you know. And the thing about Spider-Man or Superman is that we sort of want to believe it's the same character all the time, and he's never changed. You know, I was on the plane yesterday, and they were showing the first Iron Man. And I was thinking, you know, it's embedded in sort of the current Middle Eastern conflicts. That's where he gets his heart surgery. Yeah. Whereas, of course, in the comic, it was Vietnam.
Viet Cong, yeah.
But that would make him how old? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's sort of basic flaws because they didn't think that the character would be around that long, obviously.
Nor should you. You shouldn't be thinking about problems with your comic that you might have in 30 years.
No.
You should just be like, what's the story you want to tell now?
But I think the attraction of whether it's comic books like Preacher, Sandman, you know, the original Watchmen, is that you feel I'm buying into the world created by the creators that I accept as the creator.
Yeah.
And I think that
Cerebus as well, good example.
Cerebus is a great example.
Yeah.
And Love and Rockets, you know.
Yep.
So the idea that other creators will then determine part of the fate of your characters some way or other is, I think we sort of resist that. We enjoy seeing Sherlock Holmes remade or Tarzan or whatever. We're looking for that. Let's see what these guys do with it.
Yeah.
But it's not like nobody's remaking The Watchmen. They're actually sort of inserting themselves into the mythology.
It's a fine line between the pro comics and fan fiction. And like the line to me is so poof.
Yeah.
You know, because with your book, I'm sure people have like done fan fiction, and you know, especially when the movie comes out, there'll be / fan fiction. There'll be like tons of stuff that people will do, and it's like, well, that's all well and good.
I love seeing, you know, I'm now in the position that I haven't seen any fan fiction, but certainly some people submit ideas for stories. Send me pinups or whatever, and it's great to see how people are reacting and interreacting. Because that's sort of a flattering aspect of it. But the moment somebody says, you know, we're going to do a prequel to Elephant Men without your permission, and I'm able to say, well, actually, you can't. You know, that's the world I place myself in. And you know, Kirkman did that famous little video statement about why people should do creator-owned books. And out of that, he inspired John Layman to do Chew, which is, you know, a really well-received and successful Image series. And when Kirkman made that statement, I'd sort of, that's part of my DNA because of Dave Sim, because of Love and Rockets, because of the Creators' Rights Summit, where they determine the 12 things that creators should consider before they sell a property or before they develop a property. And I think it was great that Kirkman, you know, at 28 years old, sort of figured that out for himself and made a statement because it's been missing. And unless people understand what is at risk, what is to gain and what is to lose when you sell your property to a publisher, then we're going to have lots more Watchmans. But I think that statement that DC has made, which I remember an editor at Marvel saying to me once, you know, that the Marvel attitude towards creators was, we don't care who you are. We don't care who you are. We can fire you tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could be writing and drawing She-Hulk today, as an example. And not doing it tomorrow. And that happened regularly because there is this sort of inherited sort of form of arrogance that, you know, we own this character. You are just work for hire and you'd better remember it. And sadly, that is the way that machinery works. And only if you sort of put yourself out there. And I have so much respect for anyone that puts themselves out there, self-publishes, self-finances, has an idea and follows through with it. and takes the knocks. You know, that's how I was inspired reading Cerebus or Love and Rockets, or you know, and I was inspired by Roy Thomas writing Conan too for 115 issues. Mm-hmm. And I was so annoyed when they fired him. You know, and then
I'm sure people were annoyed when they fired Claremont from X-Men as well. You know, like, you know,
because I bought into that world and that mind. And sometimes I didn't like what Claremont
decision,
did.
Right? Yeah. It's not an aesthetic decision.
Well, you tie it in as well to the Marveling, like, you somehow connect it to the heroes, and there's a nobility, and there's a this, and we're all this. And you read the press releases and Stan's soapbox, and it's like, I know this world. And there's so much love you bring to it that when you see that cold business sense, it just jars you.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's significant to comics and movies in a way that it kind of detracts from its stature as art, that is that part of it. You know, there is no book called Catchiest in the Rye, right? There's no second, you know, no serialization, or they didn't give the book to someone else to do it because this is a popular book. Let's
Catcher
do another
in the Rye
one.
Yeah, too.
Let's do a prequel before Catcher. Yeah.
This time it's personal. You know, it's you know, that detracts from that element of comics and why, you know, why people want comics to be treated seriously. Yeah. Why isn't it treated seriously? Well, because
but also, you know, what happened to the days of, I don't know how many issues of Thor Simonson did, but it's a bloody thick hardcover. So he must have done it for 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. And these days, you know, you see a lot of 6-issue commitments or 12-issue commitments. You know, I was really pleased that Jonathan Hickman wrote Fantastic Four for 2 years because I really enjoyed that book. But these days you sort of expect it to end and another creative team comes along with another take.
Yeah.
But you know,
but that's what the Marvel wants, isn't it? Because they don't want, I don't think they want an associated name tied to a title like they had with X-Men. You know,
well,
it's just too much.
Yeah.
It's too much.
I mean,
grief.
Bendis has been around a long, long time now, over 10 years, maybe 12. And he's been on Avengers for a long time. So there's still that aspect there.
But for all of that, what's more important? If they do something in the movie, that's going to be more important than any idea that Brian Michael Bendis ever has.
Yes.
If they introduce a new character called Shoxi in the Avengers, and he's the shocking wisecracker, you're going to see that in the Avengers very shortly, regardless of what the creators in the comics want, because that's the big money maker over there. I'm sorry to be wrapping things up, but we're going
to
get kicked out of this hotel very shortly.
Very shortly, and Richard has a signing to do.
I do.
So everyone, we all got to pull our pants back on.
So we didn't even get to everything. I really wanted to talk more about Doctor Who, but we didn't really get to that. But next time.
Or Elephant Men, perhaps.
Or Elephant Men. Well,
monthly from Image Comics.
Or the
paperbacks available in your local comic book store.
That's true. Or out of town. Why not travel out of town and shop there as well? See the world, by God.
Or Amazon. There Amazon.
I think we normally do our plugs at the end. I think you have done your plugs quite well. And is there a website that people can go to see?
You can go to hipflask.com. You can also download issues 0 and 1 of Elephant Men on Comixology for free.
Yes.
we're issued day and date on Comixology every issue.
Wow. That's great. And what about Comiccraft or
comicbookfonts.com is where you get the fonts.
That's right.
Comiccraft.com has a portfolio of logos and comic book trade collections we've designed by the incredible John J.G. Rochelle, who's been working for me 20 years this year.
Yeah.
Wow.
There is a rumor that Comic Sans causes lupus. I don't know if that's true.
I don't know if that's true.
I've just heard it. And I just say, don't take the risk. Go get a nice professional font.
And everyone knows that lupus is a form of becoming a werewolf.
That's right.
Yes.
That's absolutely right. We learned that in Doctor Who season 2 of the David Tennant. I don't know. Anyway, normally I'd plug my stuff, but we've gone on too long. I do comedy. Come to Vancouver and see me do comedy. Ian Boothby.
I'm David Edrick. These are what voices sound like the third day into a con.
That's right. Thanks for listening to Sneaky Dragon. Thanks to Richard Starkings.
Thank you, Seattle.
Thank you, America. What a country. What? My phone is ringing about 17 times. My wife probably is on fire. I've got to go check this. Thanks to all of you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.